Thanks for tuning in to the Eastern Current Saltwater Fishing Podcast presented by Florida Fishing Products. I've been fishing the Florida reels for a few seasons now, and I've been nothing but impressed. The quality and durability of the reels are second to none. The Solus, Bahia, and Osprey CE Pro cover all the bases for your inshore light tackle setups, whether you're a weekend warrior or a year-round guide. If you like pulling on big fish, they've got you covered as well with the Resolute Series reels. Go check out their reels online at floridafishingproducts.com or click the link in the podcast show notes. On today's episode, I get the pleasure of sitting down with Captain Mike Holiday. I met Captain Mike through Bahia Sunglasses, but he's been a charter captain down in Florida since 1986. We talk all about his fishing experiences, as well as the grass loss in the area he fishes along the coast of Florida. Hope y'all enjoy the episode. Cape Fear Skiff Company builds their one-of-a-kind, indestructible aluminum skiffs right here in Wilmington, North Carolina. If you're looking for a flat skiff that pulls, rides, and performs just as good as a fiberglass boat and stands the test of time one oyster bar after another, Cape Fear Skiff Company has the boat for you. Matt and Cooper don't just build an awesome boat, they understand the importance of top-notch customer service. If you're interested in checking out one of their boats, go follow their Instagram at Cape Fear Skiff Co. or check out their website, which you can find a link to in the podcast show notes. If you're like us here at Eastern Current, your boat trailer takes a beating. That's why we want to tell you about Coastal Trailer Repair, located here in Wilmington, North Carolina. At Coastal Trailer Repair, they strive to bring quality work at a reasonable price, specializing in trailer hubs, springs, and all things electrical and wiring. If you have an issue with your trailer, look no further than Coastal Trailer Repair to get you back on the road. You can find their information in the podcast show notes. Being on the water day in and day out throughout the season, our boats take a beating. Whether we need fiberglass work, new non-skid, hull painting, rigging, and electrical, or full-blown custom restoration, Brock Boatworks has you covered. Specializing in high-end skiffs, bay boats, and center consoles, their attention to detail and customer service ensures that you have the work done right the first time so you don't have to get it done again. You can find their information in the podcast show notes. If I'm fishing a jig, you can bet it's going to be an iStrike Texas Eye. Dave and Ralph at iStrike have built the most versatile and durable lineup of jigs in the saltwater industry. Whether you need a finesse presentation on spooky wintertime redfish, or you need to hop a big swim bait on deep water structure for cobia and bull redfish, iStrike has the jig for you. Be sure to check out their website and use code EC10 for up to 40% off all iStrike products and 10% off all Z-Man products. The code can only be used at iStrikeFishing.com, and you can find the code and the link to their website in the podcast show notes. I've teamed up with Florida Fishing Products to outfit my guide service with their spinning reels, braided line, and fluorocarbon leader, and I'm looking forward to giving you some real-world feedback on their gear. I've been enjoying their Osprey CE for all my light tackle, redfish, and speckled trout, and Resolute for my beefier setups for big reds, cobia, tarpon, and jacks. I'm looking forward to helping further their mission to equip anglers to fish better, which couldn't align closer with our values here at Eastern Current. Be sure to check out their website, floridafishingproducts.com, or ask about them at your local tackle shop. Temple Fork Outfitters is the rod of choice for all of us here at Eastern Current. Whether we're fly fishing for shallow water redfish, sight casting to cobia from a tower, or dropping live pinfish to grouper in 100 feet of water, they have the rod for the job. Their customer service is unmatched by any rod company out there, and their rods can take the beating of everyday guide use without any issues. My favorite rod for redfish and speckled trout is their 7-foot medium light tactical inshore spin rod. Be sure to check out their website, tforods.com. Thank you.
Captain Mike, thanks for joining me on the podcast. We've been trying to do this for a little while, and thankful for your patience, and excited to have you on tonight.
Thanks, man. We both got busy schedules, and it gets in the spring, and things just pick up. It gets crazy right away.
It does.
Just trying to line it up. It's like herding cats.
It is. I don't know about fishing guides down your way, but I know myself and the fishing guides that I associate with, we're not the most organized people in the world. So it's just something that happens sometimes. But well, cool. Well, let's jump into your story. We haven't had you on the podcast before, so just kind of share your backstory, where you grew up, and how your life has kind of brought you to this, you know, full life and career in the outdoor and fishing industry.
Yeah, you know, I've been fortunate. I grew up in South Florida till I was 12. And then my mom took a job with Princeton University. I moved to New Jersey. I was there till I was 18. But it's hard to grow up with bare feet and being around the water and then live in a place where you got to wear shoes all the time. So as soon as I turned 18, I came back to Florida to go to college. Went to FIT. Had a Jensen Beach campus, and that's what brought me to the town I live in now. And went to school for aquaculture, got out of there, and job opportunities were pretty limited. But I really didn't research the salary range. So as soon as I got out, I found out how dismal that was. And ended up being a lifeguard, taking a full-time job as a lifeguard on the beaches of Martin County. And I did that for about 18 years, during which time I worked part-time as a fishing guide. I got my captains and worked part-time as a fishing guide. I worked in tackle shops and also started writing for the Miami Herald, writing about fishing. And if you know anything about living in South Florida, it's very expensive. So there is no such thing as having one job. You know, you're usually juggling two or three jobs at a time. And that's pretty much what I've been doing since I was, 23, 24. Busy all the time, but living the dream. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I have these jobs that I love that have really, really helped my life move forward. And let me, you know, be in the outdoors and in the outdoor field my whole life. So I've seen it from a lot of different directions. I was the editor of a couple different magazines. I was the marketing guy for Maverick Boat Company for about 5 years. I ran the marketing for the sunglass company and for Costa. And then now I run the marketing, saltwater marketing for Bahio Sunglasses. Those are my full-time jobs. And then I guide every day that I'm off.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm you know, I'm very fortunate. I get, even my part-time job, I get to be out on the water and see things that I love.
Absolutely. And I think too, I've guided not nearly as long as you have, but in the time that I have, about 13 years, I've kind of realized the importance as a guide to build some other streams of revenue as well, not just have to rely on pretty days on the water to be able to make money. So I think it's cool what you've done and kind of established just a good network of jobs almost that kind of allow you to do what you love and be in the industry that you love, but also a little bit safer than just making money when it's sunny, if that makes sense.
Well, and that's the problem with being a full-time guide is, you know, the weather patterns are finicky, and you can get 3 days, 3 weeks, or 3 months of wind.
Right.
And all of a sudden,
or 3 years, it feels like lately.
Well, exactly. And pressure ramps up when the wind's been blowing for 2 weeks and you have been canceling trips and you just feel the need, like, I got to bring some income in.
Right.
And going out on days that are not, you know, aren't going to be great from the start. I mean, you may catch the fish, but it's just not even going to be fun because you're battling the wind the whole day. It's tough. So for sure, having another, you know, another revenue stream goes a really long way. And it also allows you to say, it's going to suck. Let's not go.
Right.
And give you that option where, you know, a lot of times when you're guiding full time, you just want to go every time you can. There's a place you can hide out of the wind and catch fish.
Right.
But getting there may not be so fun.
For sure. For sure. You always get your, you know, diehard clients that they want to go no matter what, if you're willing to. But a lot of people seem to be thankful, you know, when you're honest with them about the conditions and the weather and kind of lay it out there.
And, you know, it's funny because I used to cancel all the time. When I first started guiding, I would cancel all the time when I knew the weather was going to be bad. And I had a guy who flew in from Texas, and he said, well, you know, I'm stuck in a hotel room. I'd rather be in a boat than sitting in my hotel room, even though the wind blew. Is going to blow. So we went out and fished and crushed the big trout. And, you know, the point being, the trout don't know it's windy.
Right.
They're underneath the water. They think it's nice. So, you know, it's us who are really more impacted by it anything else. But the same goes. You know how it is. You fish a real windy day in the water, and the wind just fatigues you. And you come home, and you feel like your butt is kicked. It's worse than fishing a September day in the summer heat.
Absolutely. It's definitely if the fish are chewing, like you said, it can be awesome, but it can be such a tough grind. And some clients understand it more than others and are willing to get out there and get after it in those situations. But others, you know, you hate for someone to feel like what you're saying, you took advantage of them to go put a little income in your pocket instead of canceling when you probably should have.
It's funny, yeah, because that's exactly how you feel. It's like you took advantage of it. You feel guilty for it.
For sure.
And you really shouldn't, because you have just as much chance of catching a fish on that day as any other day.
Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about your guiding career, kind of how you fish, where you fish, and what you like to target.
Yeah, so I live in Stuart, Florida, East Coast, right on the southern terminus of the Indian River. So I'm just above Palm Beach, and that area is the tropic zone. when you head north, we're tropic until you hit about Sebastian. So you have about a 45-mile range of tropic zone. So a lot of the fish that we have a longer growing season because it tends to be warmer. We tend to have, you know, in the past, we had massive sea trout. That's what we were really known for. And also probably the biggest snook in the state. So real strong snook population, real strong sea trout population. A lot of migratory species, cobia, pompano come in the wintertime. Big jacks, ladyfish. So, you know, kind of a mixed bag. Our red fishing is okay. Not amazing. It never was. Seems the further north you got, to get towards Vero Beach, Fort Pierce,
yeah,
it just got better the further north you went. But, you know, snook was always what we relied on, snook and big trout, when we fish inside. And we're fortunate, if we want to go outside, if we get a nice day and you can run out on the beach, it's, you know, 8 miles out, you're in 120 feet of water.
Wow.
So there's a lot of days you can run out and catch sailfish and come back in and catch tarpon, catch snook. We
That's
get permit
special.
Runs on the beach. We do. We're very fortunate. The real advantage of where I live is the diversity of the different species that you can get and the quality of them. I mean, when a permit are in, average fish is probably 25 pounds.
Wow.
You know, and we catch fish all the way up to 40 pounds or so.
Are those shallow fish when you stay on the beach, or are you getting them on the wrecks and stuff offshore?
We see them in the power plant outflows. We see them on wrecks.
Gotcha.
Years ago, we used to have a lot of them that would run the beach. And, I mean, I've caught them. I've actually had where there was a kid that was throwing a topwater plug from the beach into the school and kind of messing it up for me. And I went over and explained to him what they were and gave him some jigs. And he caught two of them from the beach.
That's awesome.
And while he's fighting them, I can go over and fish the school. But even that's really changed. The dynamic of our fisheries have really changed in the last, I'm going to say, 10 or 12 years, in several different ways. I mean, the stuff out front, the sharks have really impacted the fisheries.
Yeah.
Like a permit fishery, these are migrating, spawning fish. So they would show up around April. We would have them all the way to about August. They would push further north in September and October, and then as soon as it got cold, they would roll all the way back down south, south of us. But the schools, like on a dry day, you might be on a wreck in 60 feet of water, which is probably 4 miles off the beach, and there may be 1,000 fish at any given school. And I mean, they're all giant. They're all giant. And when you hook a fish, your biggest problem is you got to get them out of school. So yeah, the tails of the other fish don't break you off. And I mean, that's how it was 10 or 12 years ago. And now it's because the sharks are so bad, the schools just don't come here anymore. And, you know, our schools now are more like 30 fish, 40 fish, and not as abundant. And, you know, if you see a school on the beach, it's traveling somewhere. It's not, you're not going to go back and fish out 3 or 4 days in a row.
That's crazy. What do you think it has been that's driven the shark population up so much?
I'm sure it's a combination of a lot of things. We used to have a big time commercial shark fishery here. They netted them as well as hook and lined them, and they finned them for shark fin soup. And I think when they, you know, they said you can't throw the body of a fish away anymore, you got to take the whole fish. They're not able to carry as much, and they just don't have the, you know, the avenue to sell the meat. So they just stopped fishing. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, you've eliminated a commercial shark fishery. And at the same time, it really seemed like there was a coincidence when the BP oil spill happened in the Gulf and they sprayed all that dispersant. You know, the next year, all of a sudden we had all these giant bull sharks all over our coast, not juveniles. We weren't seeing the juveniles inshore. All we were seeing were giant, you know, 400 pounders. Wow. And they were everywhere. Even in the winter, which we typically didn't see the big bull sharks in winter. We have one wreck that the sharks would come to in the summer. They would show up in July and August, late June, right around Father's Day, they'd show up. And, you know, that was actually a wreck that you went to try and catch Kobe off the sharks. But now it's every wreck. And it's really, in some places, if you go out to, you know, the reef and shut down within 5 minutes of shutting down, there's a shark underneath your boat.
That's crazy.
So, it's pretty extreme. It's gotten to the point where, you know, in a lot of cases, and it's worse the further south you go, in a lot of cases, the guys that are bottom fishing, half their catch is getting eaten. So, you know, when you think about the actual mortality of the fish, and let's pick a fish like a cobia. You know, to catch your limit of cobia, you might have to, you know, to catch a cobia, you might have to feed two to the sharks. The big ones always get eaten. The sharks eat the big ones. So, you know, you got to catch one that's 30 pounds, not one that's 50 or 40 even. And so you might lose two or three of the sharks just to catch a fish. And, you know, that's not counted in the mortality to the population. It's the same snapper fishing, you know, to land 5 snapper aggregate, you got to feed them 10 or 15. So you're actually killing, you know, 15 or 20 fish every time you're going.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that adds up. You just can't sustain that for very long.
Right.
And it's gotten so bad. There's so many sharks. There's just not enough food. And they're just starting to push their way inshore now. And, you know, we have them on the beach right now horribly. Year when we get the big jack schools on the beach, you know, 200 to 1,000 big jacks, 20 pounds and up, all circled up in a big school. And, you know, we go out and throw flies at them or throw topwater plugs at them. And it's about a 50% mortality rate right now.
Golly.
And we never had that before. 5 years ago, never happened.
Wow.
You might get this exact time of year where April, the hammerheads would show up. So the hammerheads would focus on the jacks in April and May, and then they moved to the tarpon in June, in early July. But, you know, in a normal April and May, I might lose fish the whole 2 months to a hammerhead. Where now, I fished last Thursday, we hit 11. We caught 6, broke 2 off, and we had 3 eaten by sharks.
Wow.
And you know, one of the hammerheads that ate him was probably 1,000 pounds. Probably the biggest one I've seen in 20 years.
That is wild.
And I mean, 200 yards from the beach, man.
Yeah, just giants. You don't really hear much of like hammerhead attacks on people, though, really, I don't feel like.
No, I they seem to be very discretionary. You know as well as I do, sharks are so fast. If you stepped in the water and you're 5 steps in and a shark's 20 yards out when you see it, you know, you won't have time to yell, oh, shit, much less turn around and get out of the water before you stop to it. If you want
to. Yeah, it's
to.
Over.
So they don't want you.
No.
You know, they're looking for something else. But the bulls, you know, I've had the bull shark swim up and grab my trolling motor and shake the boat 4 or 5 times. I've had them grab a running prop. I've had them grab my trim tabs. You know, they're just coming up and testing. So, you know, if you're what they test, that would be very unfortunate.
Very unfortunate.
And we're seeing a lot more in the summer. A lot of guys snook fish around the inlets. It's all catch and release. And we're seeing them now coming in the inlet and eating the snook as well. So, you know, guys that are just trying to catch a fish and let it go and have some fun, they're you know, increasing the mortality on that species just by fishing them. And it's everything. It doesn't really matter what you fish for.
Yeah.
Kingfish on the beach, same deal.
Wow. So tell me this, just curious where you fish, and it sounds like you fish a large variety of types of water and styles of fishing. What do you run boat-wise? What have you run over the years, and kind of what have you found that fits you best?
Yeah, so you know, again, I've been fortunate. I worked at Maverick Boat Company, run in there marketing, and was one of the pros for a long time. Before I started working for them, I was one of their pros. So I've had a lot of their products. I've had had 5 Mavericks, 2 Hughes's, and 21 Pathfinders in my days.
Wow.
And yeah, been, you know, been cool. My favorite boat ever was a 21 Maverick Master Angler.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like just the aircraft carrier flats boat.
Didn't they bring really that back nice. Recently? Have they brought that back?
They came back with a 21 Hughes, which is just like it.
Okay.
It's almost the exact same boat.
Got it.
And that has always been a great, you know, 3 live wells, lots of storage, great fly rod storage, and just a giant deck to walk around, so nobody's ever in your way. The drawback is as you get older and you're sitting on that back deck, and I had chairs in my Maverick on the back deck, and it's still, you know, it hurts your back when you hit a wave rock. So I've matriculated towards Pathfinders towards bay boats.
Okay.
And started with 22 Pathfinders. I've run the 24, I've run the 23. I've fished out of the 25, 26, and 27s. My very favorite is a 23 Pathfinder, and I've had, 8 of those, I believe, now. And that's what I'm currently running.
Gotcha.
23 Pathfinder.
And that's kind of been your favorite, you said, that you've kind of landed on.
Yeah, you know, it's a step haul. It runs goes down. So it lets that V in the bow cut the chop really well. It's a very fast boat. It gets up on plane really quick. I run a 250 Yamaha shell on it with a 4-blade prop, jumps it right up and, you know, in a boat length. So even out in the ocean, when you have that wind chop, you can jump up quick and not have to worry about blowing out. And even if you're skipping across waves, we end up the beach a lot, where we're, you know, 20 miles up the beach and got to run back against the wind. And not having to go to a big, heavy bay boat is kind of nice.
For sure.
Well, it's kind of nice when we fish in the winter. Most of our winter spent inshore in the Indian River because of prevailing wind to northeast, and we have a lot of rough seas. We don't get as many days as we can get out, so we're inside in the wind a lot. So it's kind of nice to have a lighter boat that you can get up on the flats and get between docks and maneuver a little easier.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's I run a 22 Pathfinder myself, the TRS, and then an HPXS. So we have a lot of really shallow fishing here for our redfish, and a little shallow boat is pretty necessary if I want to fly fish on a regular basis inshore. So between those two, it's a good combination.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the best of both worlds, right?
You have to own two boats, which stinks, but outside of that.
Look, I would have two boats as well.
Sorry, say that again. I lost you there for just a second.
I love getting skinny. Having two boats is great.
For sure.
And, you know, the nice thing about the poling skiffs is you can get away from the people. You can get where a lot of boats can't get. And you know, be a little more personal with the fish. But for that being said, to be a guide, you're limiting yourself to, you know, two clients. What happens when somebody's got a family, or the guy's got, it's a dad and two kids, you know, or mom and dad and kids. And, you know, you take away fishing opportunities as well as, you know, fun days that are out on, that you get to be out on the water. So the bigger boat is really nice. That really is the best of both worlds. I would love to have a technical poling skiff.
Oh, yes. I accidentally just bumped the FaceTime button on the phone when I picked it up, so sorry about that. I wasn't trying to start a video with you.
No, I was wondering who it was, actually.
I just picked my phone up to look at the time, and I saw a video of myself. I was like, oh, gosh, FaceTime. But, no, the two boats is great. The only part about two boats is it's just more things to have to tinker with and fix up. But that's just part of the – I mean, that's part of the poison, if you will. But yeah, I've loved ever since I landed on Maverick boats. It's been the perfect fit for what I do. And there's, you know, with the 22 that I run, it's sometimes, you know, days that I wish I could be a little more comfortable in the ocean. Like I can be out there, but maybe I've got some older clients. But most of my money is made inside the inlets. So it really is nice to be able to carry a bigger group of people, but go sit in a foot of water and still be able to bait fish for some redfish in an area that I could go fly fish for them on my skiff. So it allows me to kind of tune all my fishing together as to where, like, if I had a deeper drafting bay boat, I would have to be targeting different fish. Like I can kind of a day of scouting, I can find stuff that works for both my boats, if that makes sense.
No, that's exactly it. My 23 goes in 11 inches.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And in the wintertime, I'm sight fishing pompano in 12 inches.
That's awesome.
I mean, it's one of my very favorite things to do. So it affords a lot of opportunity. And, you know, what I tell anybody who buys a boat is think about what you're going to do the most and find the boat that's good for that. You know, there's a lot of good boats out there. I had a hard time going from a 21-foot Maverick to a bay boat. And I was worried because every now and then I'd like to pole. And pulling that 21 wasn't fun, but I can pole it. And I really enjoyed poling. And Scott Deal, the president of Maverick, pulled me aside and said, you know, how many days do you actually pole? And I thought about it. I said, you know, probably 5 or 6 a year. And he goes, so you're going to give up all that comfort, all that space, you know, the ability to take more people, just more opportunity for 5 or 6 days. I mean, don't you think you'll make those up? And you know, that's the reality of it is.
For sure.
Is I'm just being short-sighted because of things I like to do.
Right.
And I really don't do them that much that it matters. There really is no boat that does everything.
No, definitely not.
It's not out there. So
it's hard to have two boats that do everything, or it's impossible, really.
You really need three.
You need three boats.
A good offshore boat. You need a good offshore boat. And you need a good, like, beach bay boat that you can take inside when it's rough. And then you need a technical poling skiff. Yeah. I would love to have a technical poling skiff just for myself.
Yeah, just a little tiller skiff.
That's what
something
I want to
fun.
Go do. Yeah.
What would be your choice if you had a little poling skiff? Just for you. Just for fun fishing.
If it's any choice, it's a little 17 HPX.
Nice.
They're just a badass boat. I mean, they're such a nice
that,
boat.
You're talking about the older boat, right? It's a They don't make those anymore.
That's correct.
Yeah, I love those, man.
That's
those
correct.
Are such cool little boats. That big single back hatch on it.
And they pull so straight. You know, they just pick a lane and they stay out of it. Doesn't matter what the wind's doing, you're not gonna kite. They're just a great platform. And big enough that You know, I'm a fairly big guy to begin with. You put two big guys on there. If they start moving around, it gets tipsy. With that 17, it's not doing that.
Yeah.
It's just wide enough that you're very comfortable at all times.
That's awesome. So I know we had some stuff we want to get into talking about the water quality issues down there in your area. Do you want to kind of take us through what y'all have had going on the past few years and kind of the battle y'all are up against right now?
Yeah, sure. So you know, really started early 1900s when you know, we're made a national park and protected and you know, and valued. And then as we started getting more of a population, the land north of the Everglades, which was always called the River of Grass, Lake Okeechobee would overflow, and that water would flow south through the weeds, through the grass. I called it the River of Grass. And the grass would clean all the water, and it would...
Yeah.
Florida Bay, we'd go at about a mile and a half a day, and by the time it got to Florida Bay, it was crystal clear water. And, you know, in the 30s and 40s, they decided to create an area south of the lake. They found out that if you dry up some of that, it has the richest soil, some of the richest soil on the planet. So they started drying it up. To do that, they were going to have to stop the water from flowing. So they built a dike around Okeechobee, and then they built canal to the east coast. We never had a canal that dumped onto our coast, and then increased the canal to the west coast. So they diverted most of the water to the east and west coast. And, you know, you only got water at certain periods, typically during the rainy season. It wasn't every year. If a hurricane comes and the lake gets too high, they would just flush all this water out to the coast because, you know, it was a danger that the dike could break and flood the town south of the lake. Really about a third of the water that used to go to the Everglades now goes to the Everglades. So we've been getting this water since about 1940 or so. And, you know, periodically we get it. We get it every few years. Sometimes we get it 2 years in a row. It all depends. And the length of water and the volume of water is different. But you know, I've seen discharges of a billion and a half gallons a day for 200 days, you know. And you have these saltwater estuaries. And when you dump that much water in them, 40 or 50 days alone, eventually they turn fresh. As a rule, the saltwater is less dense, or freshwater is less dense than saltwater, so it floats above the saltwater. So when it first starts, the water near the bottom is still salt. The water on top is fresh. And the fish can live through it. The seagrasses, the oysters, the shrimp, everything can live through it. But once you get, you know, 30 or 40 days of that volume, it all turns fresh. And then you start having seagrass loss. You start having die-offs of the oysters. You know, everything that filters the water. And from there, it's a trickle down. And we've seen it. So I've been here since 78. And I've seen it pretty bad. Every year, it seems like, you know, we'd lose a little bit of seagrass. But, you know, it would come back after we'd have 2 or 3 or 4 years that you didn't have. You know, these discharges. And then about 2011, 2012, we had these discharges for about 200 days. We had a billion gallons of water a day for over 200 days. And I don't know what happened, man. In a year, we went from these lush seagrass meadows that went all the way across the river. The Indian River's, it's not super wide. It's probably 2 or 3 miles wide. 2 or 3 feet deep. So it's these massive seagrass meadows that go all the way across the river with the intercoastal channel cut through the middle of it. And in a matter of a year, all the grass was gone. And when you take all the grass, you know, you basically take fish, the whole food chain with it. You take the shrimp, you take the fish, you take, you know, the, the predator fish, it all sort of disappears. When the grass dies, anything that's exposed, when you get migratory fish like the pompano and the jacks and the ladyfish and the bluefish, we get a lot of bluefish, they'll come in, they eat everything. So what can't hide is gone. And what can get out of the way is gone. They just moved to other places. And we went from this amazing fishery that I would tell you, you could go anywhere in the world, and I would tell you it's still better where I live. Our fishery was so good. Our, you know, it's, our sea trout fishing was spectacular, particularly for trophy fish.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanted to catch a fish over 10 pounds, this is where you came. And I'll give you an example. On a typical day, April or May, when I was live bait fishing, I would shoot for 30 snook and 3 or 4 trout, knowing that all trout are going to be over 6 pounds.
Wow.
And probably we'll get one over 9 or 10 every day. And 30 snook was just just sort of an arbitrary number. That's an average day. Let's shoot for 30. You know, you certainly have plenty of 50 and 60 fish days. And now, I probably catch one trout a year. And I didn't catch any 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I didn't catch any that year. I caught two last year. And I've caught one so far this year. And I shoot for, 10 snook on a trip.
Yeah.
It's changed that dramatic. When you take, 75-80% of the habitat out of the river, you lose 75-80% of the population. It's just how it works, So now our inshore fishing is primarily around docks and seawalls. That's the main habitat. So stuff that I never fished before, I never fished docks. I hated docks. Bridges. I was always out on the flats. There were no boat wakes. It's quiet. And you can get some 30-pound snook on any given day.
Yeah.
Now I'm on a dock with going by me all day and shaking me. And the minute I pull away from that dock, there's somebody else pulling there to fish.
Yeah.
Because there's only so many docks that hold fish. The change has been dramatic. Water's diverted to keep the land, the farmland, which is primarily sugar. It's about 60,000 acres and probably 440,000 acres of it is sugar cane. It's diverted so that they have optimum growing conditions all year. And the lake is kept artificially high so they have all the water they want. So they keep the lake high, and when we get a lot of rain, then they got to discharge it. And they can't discharge it south because the farmland's there. So, it's a mess, man. And it's a profit-driven mess for one industry that's kind of killing us. And we're seeing it all over South Florida.
Mm.
Kind of accelerating. When they discharge it to the West Coast, it feeds the red tides and destroys their seagrasses as well. And then the Everglades are not getting the water they historically wanted, so they're getting too salty. And that's killing the grass.
Yeah.
And, it's sad because everybody knows the answer. There's a solution, which is to send the water south. The Everglades want it. We don't want it. They need it. We don't need it. The solution's obvious. And the only thing stopping it is the sugar industry right now.
Golly. Do you think that's something that we're ever going to see change? Or do you think it's just going to be one of the things we destroy here on this earth?
I think our economies are so based on water that we need to have healthy environments. And people are pretty up in arms about it right now.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see more of a shift. We've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a lot of positive impacts. They had this thing called the Everglades Restoration Plan, which was 68 of these different projects that they created that would drain the water, would hold the water, would clean the water and get it south. And then the water that was going east and west would get cleaned as well. It's not just the volume of water, it's also the quality of the water.
Yeah.
Has a lot of nutrients. It has a lot of phosphorus and a lot of nitrogen in it, as well as a lot of turbidity, a lot of plant matter that settles to the bottom. And when the wind blows, you know, it all stirs up so then light can't penetrate and the grass can't grow. So they've had this plan that it's the solution. And they announced it in 2000. It was supposed to be a 20-year plan. And, you know, here we are in 2024 and, you know, it's still not done. And it's really the last 5 years have been when most of the work's gotten done. I do a lot of work with Captains for Clean Water, and those guys are on the forefront of it. And they're the ones who are really getting out there and affecting change and calling people out, politicians as well as the sugar industry on these disruptive practices that are diverting money away from that happening. Wow. But that being said, the keystone of it all is this reservoir south of the lake, which will take the water, clean it, and then send it to the Everglades. And, everybody's trying to divert money away from it. It's still not fully funded. If it's not fully state funded or federally funded, but the money's coming. We're seeing more money every year than we've ever seen. And if it gets fully funded, then it'll be done by 2030.
Wow.
And really, nothing's going to change. It's only going to get worse until 2030, really.
Gotcha.
So, like, you can't plant sea grass because you're going to plant it and they're going to divert the water to the coast and it's all going to die. So there's no reason to even start on the replanting or any of the projects that might help the environment until you get the water controlled.
That makes sense.
And we're moving in the right direction, dude. It's, you know, it the public pressure has really, really ramped up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be just fishermen and people that were out on the water complaining about it. But now you have all these businesses that are impacted. Every time the water goes bad, you know, all these waterfront businesses, they're impacted. Anybody who lives on the water, you know, what's the value of a waterfront home if you can't use the water out behind your house?
Right.
So they start saying, like, why am I paying taxes for something that's not that special?
Yeah, that makes sense. That definitely makes sense. So many other people are starting. It takes a little bit longer, like you're saying, but they're starting to feel the pressure from it and the issues.
It's a good, you know, it's really the first time we've seen something like this where there's a solution and everybody's working towards fixing the problem.
Yeah.
We have pick a place in the country. I mean, everywhere it's got water problems right now. Go to Chesapeake Bay, go to San Francisco Bay. It doesn't really matter. There's all these water issues. And, you know, this project will be one that kind of can lay the groundwork for what we have to do and show that these estuaries can come back. We just got to take care of them. We got to be careful about what we pour into our estuaries. And it's also a testimony that, you know, one day you can have it and then a year later it can all be gone, man.
Yeah.
I've seen it firsthand. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is wild. That is wild. Well, that's cool to hear that it's going so well. And it's, you know, with Captains for Clean Water, I feel like being out of the state, you think so much of it's about the Everglades. But like you're saying, everybody's affected down there. Every little body of water, really, that gets any of that diversion of fresh water is greatly affected, you know, as the Everglades is too, from not getting it.
It's all of South Florida, and it includes Lake Okeechobee.
Yeah.
You know, the second largest lake in this country. And then the Everglades are the second largest national park in this country.
Yeah.
Like, you can't let those things go to waste, really?
Right.
In our lifetime, we're going to see that? Come on, man.
Yeah, that's crazy. That is crazy. Well, is there anything else that you want to touch on before we wrap this podcast up? We're at about 45 minutes here and wanted to make sure I didn't leave anything untouched that you wanted to chat about.
No, you know, it's we're all very fortunate to be out on the water and get to do the things and free our minds like we do. Just everyone, like, nobody wants to be an activist, but just pay attention to what's going on where you live.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there's problems, you just need to speak up. There's typically a solution. And once you find the solution, then work towards that solution. If you don't, then you're the guy who ends up looking back and going, man, I wish I would have done more when I was younger.
Yeah.
I wish I wouldn't have. Dude, I never thought I would be involved in this fight like I am. And it's to the point now that you either fight or move, and I'm not moving.
Yeah.
You know, you start seeing things destroyed to where your day goes from, you know, being just amazing to a struggle.
Yeah.
And it gets very frustrating, and that starts to mount up. And then you just get to the point where you go, I got to do something. I got it. And really, you know, for most people in the fight, we're looking at it for the next generation.
Right.
For making life better for them, so they could see the things that we saw when we were young. And nature is very resilient, man. It'll come back. You gotta stop the problem, you know, that's causing the problem. And then, you know, work towards rebuilding everything, and nature will take it from there.
For sure. For sure. Well, Mike, if people want to reach out to you and maybe book a trip or chat with you, what's the best way for them to do that? And again, I will link all this stuff in the show notes, but what's a good way to get up with you?
You can find me on my website, Captain Mike Holiday, 2LsInHoliday.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.
And you know, we're still, like I said, we're very fortunate. We still have some very cool fisheries. We have good tarpon fishing. We have good, the giant jacks, the snook fishing is still very good, particularly in the summertime. You know, you can still catch a permit every now and then. Offshore is right there. We've had the best whale fishing that I've ever seen in the last 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
In June and July, where I think it's better than the winter fishery.
That's awesome.
You know, you can catch 4 or 5 fish a day, then come back in and catch tarpon. Kind of cool.
That would be a fun day for sure. Wish we had that.
Come down and do it, man.
I'll have to make it happen.
I know it's probably your busy season, but dude, just come down. We'll go goof off.
Hey, you don't have to dangle that for me for very long, and I'll make it happen.
Please do. Please come, man. Bring some friends. Give me a reason to get out on the water. I always need it.
Right on. Well, we'll chat about that after the podcast and maybe make something happen. But thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with us and to share here with the listeners at Eastern Current.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, it's a privilege.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, it's a privilege to chat with you. And guys, thank you all so much for listening to another episode of Eastern Current. And as always, we appreciate you, and we will see you next week. Later.